Appreciate your all being here. Afterward, I got told to make sure you turn that thing on. I didn't. All right. Now I've got a little more freedom of movement, but did you all look outside just now? What are you doing in here? If I didn't have to be. There are a number of things I could say before I get started, but I'll just tell you one thing. I've been showing everybody, I've got an infection in my arm. My left arm looks like Popeye's. And somebody asked me how I got it. I guess I should tell them, since only one arm, I ate half a can of spinach. And that's what happened. But anyway, I'm looking for all the sympathy I can get, I guess, if this doesn't go as well as it might. I'm going to try to be brief, which is a good thing, at 3:15 or 3:20, as much as possible. Today we're going to be taking a look at 1 Corinthians chapter 10, that portion that Glenn didn't cover, at least. And the study, as I've titled it, is Idolatry and Ethics. It could be stated that every doctrine and belief, every association with an individual, even simple affirmations, propositions, comes with a potential ethical dilemma. And not just what to do and what not to do, but even in cases of what to do, how far to go. Someone has properly observed that the Old Testament law of Moses not only gave us the things that needed to be done on account of transgression of the law, but also limited it. And that perhaps was the biggest difference between it and the pagan laws of the same era. For instance, Deuteronomy chapter 24 and verse 16, the law explicitly stated that in cases of murder, you were not to take vengeance on an entire family. You could not indulge in vendetta-type justice where someone has wronged you and you say, I'm just simply going to wipe any memory of them off of the face of the earth, which was a law, incidentally, that was cited in 2 Kings chapter 14. With Amaziah, who killed his father's murderers, had them executed, but not their family. That's an interesting verse because it flies in the face of liberals who tell us that Deuteronomy was not in existence at this time, yet it cites the principle in Deuteronomy in that law. What about 1 Corinthians chapter 10? Well, 1 Corinthians chapter 10 discusses idolatry extensively. And we know from this text, as well as from others, that the service of idols is not only sinful, but extraordinarily foolish. But as we say today, concerning those who oppose it, how far do we take that? How far do we take that against the principle of idolatry and against the idolater himself? It actually follows some principles that have previously been raised in 1 Corinthians chapter 8, including the following. Number one, that the idol is literally a nothing. Some of you have maybe read both Old and New Testament. An idol described as, quote, a vain thing. Literally, that is a nothing. An idol is a nothing. Second, that spiritual purity trumps personal liberty. And third, that personal liberty may be the undoing of another. Now, in the process of this chapter, in the process of this study, we'll notice how that this discussion is broadened to cover other topics, and then by principle, ethical decisions that are made today that might have very little to do with the specific topic of idolatry. But first, in verses 14 through 22 or so, 14 through 22, 1 through 13 or so, he's talking, the first half of the chapter, he's talking about the perspective on idolatry. And he first seems to make the claim in this section that idolatry is an ever-present danger, which is a principle that I believe has been largely ignored, at least in congregations of the Lord over the past several generations. I think that what he's talking about here has been somewhat dismissed. Lessons on idolatry, references to idolatry, would focus, seemingly in my experience, almost exclusively on what's taught, say, in Colossians chapter 3 and verse 5 about covetousness. Covetousness which is idolatry. One of the things that he said are to be mortified or put to death. Covetousness, which is idolatry. People weren't thinking about literal idolatry mostly in the Lord's church just a few years ago, because our thinking was that the idols were confined to distant shores in some far-off pagan nation. And so we didn't really have to think about much about that. So when we talked about idols, we would talk about covetousness. And that's fine that people did that. That's an obvious application, and it's one that Paul made about worldliness and its similarity to literal idolatry. To have done otherwise would have been to preach against... Before I give you the punchline, it's just possible that maybe one person out of this crowd never heard this story, so I'm going to tell it to you, although I think almost everybody else has. The one about the guy that was preaching in Kentucky, I bet almost all of you heard it. Don't ruin it for me, okay? The first night he preaches against whiskey. And somebody comes up to him and said, "Brother, you may not realize this, but a lot of our members work in distilleries here. This is Kentucky." Next night he preaches against smoking. Somebody said, "Brother, you may not realize this, but a lot of our members raise tobacco. This is Kentucky." Third night he preaches against gambling. The guy said, "Kentucky Derby? Ever heard of it?" He says, "What am I going to preach on?" He said, "Why don't you preach against them heathen witch doctors? There's not one of them within 1,000 miles of here." I knew most of you had heard it before. I think that was the spirit that sort of drove what we said about idolatry. Distant shores, maybe somebody somewhere on earth is actually bowing down and worshiping an idol. But we didn't see it as an ever-present danger, and then things changed. The idolaters, the pagans, came to America. And some of the children of Americans converted. You don't need to go to Asia to find idolatry. Find it right out there on the ridge. A remote location in Moundsville, West Virginia, is a famous place of idolatry. So while it might not have been dismissed, I would say it's been this more literal, more virulent form of idolatry has at least been de-emphasized. And Paul says it's an ever-present danger. And I believe that some things in this chapter will help us to understand why it's a hard fire to put out. Now, along with that, I want you to notice that in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, in his discussion of idolatry, that he gives us some reasons why that idols are not worthy to be served. But before he does that, he's going to talk about the relationship between, or as he does that, I should say, he's going to talk about the relationship between idolatry and its connected sins. And I think those are important, and there's some principles there for you as well. All right, looking at the text, he is going to discuss first the baptism in the wilderness. That's been a source of problem for some people, and it has been misinterpreted by some others, I think perhaps even deliberately. There are those out there who cite the baptism in the wilderness, the baptism in the cloud and in the sea, supposedly as proof that New Testament baptism might be a sprinkling, a pouring, or I would argue a walking through dry ground, since that's what they did going through the Red Sea, if in fact that's correct. Or that its purpose isn't delineated. And to make that argument, it ignores the use of a metaphor in general, and this one in particular. Because far from showing us the New Testament baptism is similar in every respect to the baptism in the cloud and in the sea, what he is doing, the way he's writing, presumes that both the reader and the writer have all been immersed for the remission of sins. And if you could argue that because Israel had a typical or a type baptism, that means that New Testament baptism, the laws and regulations of it, are not reliable. You could just as easily argue that since Moses was a type of Christ, we don't really have to follow Christ. It would be just as valid, or to say we could follow some other lawgiver. That's nonsense. And it's obviously nonsense. Now, the reason that he cites this, they were all baptized in the cloud and the sea, was not, as might be tempting to presume, because there are four things that he says all participated in: the baptism, the cloud and the sea, the eating of a spiritual food, and the drinking of a spiritual drink. It might be tempting to say this is talking about the common salvation experience of all Christians, like Ephesians 4 does. and that would miss the point. It's true that all of those folks in the wilderness had experienced those things, but his point isn't that. His point is that though they had all experienced those things, with many of them, the Lord was not pleased. Almost every version except for the Old King James reads, most of them. That's his point. The baptism and the cloud and the sea should have had an impact on them, and it didn't, or at least it didn't long enough. He's not talking about comparing the two ways of being baptized. It is probable that his extensive discussion of this baptism experience, along with various citations in this chapter regarding the Lord's Supper, is significant to the Corinthians. Why? It seems that a very early form of Gnosticism had influenced this church to the point that people were under the impression that, and I find this so ironic. Ready for this? If I've been baptized, and if I partake of the Lord's Supper regularly, I'm saved no matter what. Now, that's the doctrine of Gnosticism. According to the Gnostics, you know, the enlightened, it doesn't matter what they do as long as they're enlightened. John argues against that successfully in 1 John very clearly. Whosoever commits sin transgresses the law. Sin is a transgression of the law. That's objectivity, where the Gnostics were teaching subjectivity. But I want to give you those, list those two examples. I don't know what it is about those two things. As long as I have been baptized and am partaking of communion regularly, I'm all right with God. That's what they thought in Corinth. In 2012, I mean in the first century. I bet some of you know some folks with the same theory today. They don't know they're Gnostics. And they are. Well, all right, that rock, he said. Now, you want to be careful in Old Testament examples saying, here's the spiritual application. You know, sometimes I think people go too far with these kinds of things. The four that are cited here, I think we're safe in saying were typical beyond the Old Testament narrative. For instance, you got the food, that is the manna, and the drink. Now, Jesus cited those. John chapter 6, he said, I am the bread from heaven. John chapter 7, among many other places, he claimed to be the water of life. Now, the text said they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them. There was a Jewish tradition that had that rock from Rephidim actually literally following them about the desert and spouting out water occasionally like some ancient fire hydrant. And that isn't what was happening, and this is not a verification of that theory. What he's talking about when he says that rock was Christ, verse 6, is not that Jesus was in the rock, but that Jesus Christ, presumably in concert with the Father and the Spirit, on the occasion that Moses drew water from the rock, that water came from the rock by the grace of Jesus Christ. It's the same sense that you read in 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 19 when Jesus went and preached to the spirits in prison. He did that through Noah. He gave them water through this rock. That was Jesus. Now, that was the rock of ages. And yeah, I think it is spiritually significant that our rock of ages was once upon a time back there at Rephidim providing water. And it's probably no coincidence that it was a rock. But that's how that works. Now, I haven't really gotten to the point of all this, believe it or not. Because the point is this. Most of them fell. People will contemplate those who have experienced extraordinary events in the Bible and then so quickly fall away. Oh, I do too. I mean, here were a group of people, and this is what Paul's getting at. They have experienced the unthinkable. They have gone through a sea. Dry land. You'd think when you got done with that, your God could do anything, wouldn't you? You got thirsty, He gave you something to drink. You got hungry, He gave you food. Man, you'd think you'd do anything. And they fell away. And you know, I think people miss the bigger picture here. How? How does what God did for them in the wilderness compare with what He's done for a person like you or me who's lost in sin, and He took sin of a person who was bound for hell and He cleansed them, He took it all away, and then a person like that who knows that he's been cleansed and washed and saved goes back into the world, starts wallowing in the mire, 2 Peter 2, verse 22. You tell me which one's worse. Now, in this chapter, beginning at verse 6, he begins to talk about some of the implications of service to idols, some of which perhaps are not expected. When you and I contemplate idolatry today, some of us don't move beyond in our thinking the idea of bowing down to an idol or attributing to that idol characteristics that belong to Jehovah only. And that's a view that is incomplete to the point of naivete. Because it's the lure of idolatry that's under consideration here. And I said it's a constant temptation, a constant danger. There's a reason for that. Our view of idolatry, as I said a moment ago, is incomplete to the point of naivete. And he cites, now I want you to notice this, in verses 6, 7, and 8, he cites lust, and we're going to talk about the word play in a moment, verse 7, which is from Exodus 32 and verse 6, and then fornication. Do you suppose that's a coincidence that those three things come one right after the other? Because I don't. Well, what's it have to do with that? Exodus 32 is the citation here. Let's see what it reads. If you go back to Exodus chapter 32 and verse 6, it's when Moses was coming down from Sinai. It is the golden calf incident. And it says the people, they sat down to eat and drink, and they rose up to play. The word play is probably about as far from innocent fun as anybody could imagine. Idolatry succeeds and thrives not because it makes a lick of sense, but because it invites men to debauchery. When Moses came down from Sinai, what the people were doing were probably, and in harmony with the local pagan religions, they were engaging in a number of nauseating sexual acts. It was utter and open perversion. That's what it means when it says they rose up to play. Now, if you again go back to Exodus 32, look at verses 17 through 19, or at least the first part. There are two other words that complete the picture. This is when Joshua says, there's a noise of war in the camp. Moses says, no, it's not the sound of those being defeated or of those who are victorious, but the sound of singing that I hear, and it also reads they were dancing. It does not give us a detailed description of their dancing. However, it may be hard to describe the difference between a dance that is not intended to elicit any sort of sexual feelings or have any sexual overtones and one that does, but we all pretty much know the difference when we see it. All I can tell you is they weren't having a square dance. Now the Bible also says, when he saw they were, this old King James language, they were naked. New King James reads unrestrained. ASV and ESV reads broken loose. Now, I'm not going to argue that they weren't unrestrained and broken loose. This is one case I think the old King James had it right. Now the Hebrew word can mean either thing, naked or without restraint. But given the overall picture, knowing what I know about paganism, I think what he stumbled onto, really didn't stumble onto it, God told him to go down there, but what he came upon in their camp was about as low and as perverted a group of activities as you can imagine. Now, one other thing completes the picture. Moses said, I hear singing. Now, first they thought it was a battle. He said, no, it's singing. Have you ever heard the singing of hymns at a distance? Probably many of you have. How many of you mistook that for a battle? It's different, isn't it? But you know what kind of singing? And it's hard to make out what's being sung. It's hard to make out even that it's a song. And it's a group of people who love to sing in public. Most people don't. Most people have restraints on that. You know, they're nervous about singing in public. They have to be asked to sing in public. But I'll tell you who doesn't. Drunks. Drunks love to sing in public. They'll get together in big groups and they'll just sing their little hearts out. It's hard to tell the difference between their singing and a battle. They were drunk. They were naked. Another word on naked I think I put in the lecture in the book was maybe the best explanation I can give you on that word is a southern colloquialism. I heard somebody say one time, there are two ways to pronounce the word naked in the South. One is naked and the other is naked. Naked just means not having clothes. Naked means they're up to something. Well, I think they were up to something. Now, that's one example from 1 Corinthians chapter 10. That's the connection between lust and idolatry. He takes it a step further. Remember, he talks about fornication specifically. I think in this, what we're seeing is a connection between idolatry and sensuousness in general. Sensuality. It may not be so, we may not be able to verify in every single case that the staple of all paganism, of all idolatry, is fornication, but it's quite frequent with it. And even if it isn't, it's a general brand of sensuality that includes a false humility that's actually arrogance. I think that explains why so many high-profile entertainers today have gone off into these kinds of weird religions. You know, Madonna and Britney Spears embraced Kabbalah, which is Jewish spiritualism, and Tom Cruise and John Travolta, you know, they're in Scientology. And all the people that I've told you about are marked both by low morals and very few brains. But they do that so that they can say to themselves, just like the ancient pagans said to themselves, not only are we equal to you, but we're actually superior. Why? You live like dogs. Doesn't matter. We are who we are. And I think that you all need to understand the connection between this brand of sensuality, this paganism, and what he's talking about here, because it is very prevalent today. Their variety of spirituality is self-congratulatory, self-destructive, self-deceiving. And they engage in it nonetheless. Now I want you to look at what happens in the next little section, because he has another Old Testament example from Numbers chapter 25 that again takes us maybe even to the next level, because this isn't just about sensuality. This is about a brazen arrogance in sin. In verse 8. Neither let us commit fornication, as some of them committed, and fell in one day 20,000. Now, there are some people who get all upset and say there's a contradiction because Numbers cites 24,000. What they don't seem to recognize is Numbers is talking about all those who fell. Paul said one day. So there's no real discrepancy there, and both figures are rounded off anyway. But he's citing what happened with Balaam. And if you don't remember what happened in the aftermath of Balaam, and this is the part that's important. What happened in the aftermath of Balaam was this. The women of the United Countries of Moab and Midian were sent to tempt the Israelite men, and it worked. It worked like a charm. According to Revelation chapter 2 and verse 14, Balaam taught Balak, taught them to cast a stumbling block before Israel by encouraging them to sacrifice to idols and to commit fornication. And so that's what he did. Balaam recognized, I can't curse the people of God. God's preventing me from cursing anyone, but here's what I can do. I can encourage them to curse themselves. And brethren, if we don't get the principle here, we're in big trouble. Let me tell you something. Our enemies can't destroy us. Our enemies might be able to take some lives from some Christians, but they cannot destroy us. Instead, if the church dies, it will be because it committed suicide like it did in the first centuries. The Roman emperors couldn't destroy the church. They did it themselves. We're a little like Gibbons's description of the fall of the Roman Empire in that sometimes we're worried about external forces against us in his fourth reason and not worried enough about corruption within. What happened there? Well, as I said a moment ago, it worked. And I'm of the opinion, there are probably those who will disagree with me, and that's fine, you're wrong, but you can disagree all you like. I personally think a very careful reading of this section, particularly involving an Israelite nobleman by the name of Zimri and his relationship with a Moabite woman by the name of Cozbi, is enlightening so far as the brazen arrogance associated with these pagans. What he did was he brought this woman, she was a princess slash harlot, brought her to the tabernacle, brought her right by these people who were there weeping and asking God for forgiveness and asking Him to take the plague away that was currently killing the people by thousands. He marches her right by, marches her into God's holy place. Now the Bible doesn't go into a great number of details here. And again, that's why I said you might disagree with me, but it tells us that the grandson of Aaron, Phinehas, goes in and kills them both with a javelin. Okay, here's what I think is happening. There are those who said he brought her there in order to marry her. I don't think a woman like her was interested in marriage. And I don't think he much was either. What I think he was doing was he brought her there to fornicate with her. Pagans often find their sin cute. And I think he wanted to show off what he was doing with this woman in front of everybody. And I believe that Phinehas killed them. And the most delicate way I can phrase it is in flagrante delicto, or in the act. I don't think it took two javelins. Okay, maybe you think I'm wrong. That's fine. What cannot be argued in my mind is that this spirit is prevalent today. What do you mean? I'm not talking about temptation such as we all face. I'm not even talking about those who have fallen, particularly with regard to sexual sin. There are people who do wrong things and are ashamed. They want to do better, and out of weakness they do wrong things again, and then they try and they think, I wish I could do better. Please God, help me to do better. Or if somebody comes to them, they'll hang their heads and say, I know I should do better. That's not what I'm talking about. To hear the pagans of America tell it today, they're being bullied. I guarantee you, if you listen to the news and you listen to the word bully 10 times, I'll guarantee you 5 times it will mean that somebody is telling a homosexual you can't do that. That's bullying in 21st century American vernacular. They're telling us that the morally upright are oppressing the libertines. And we're supposed to believe that. As though there's some locker room in some high school in America where the virgins are teasing the sexually active. Really? I was there, man. That's not how it goes. What color is the sky in their world? America's pagans are of the same moral fiber as their ancient brethren back with Midian and Moab. They're telling you, we will do exactly what we want. We will, or you will, not object. We will do it publicly. We will have access to your children. And we are morally superior. That's what idolatry and sensuality and worldliness in general does to people. Now, because I said I would hurry, and so far I've not done a very good job of honoring that promise, I am going to
hurry just a little bit and let you know that the rest of this section dealing with this perspective on idolatry includes the following. Well, Kaufman lists five principles that all come under the heading, I think, of a worldly attitude and of sensuality in general, and those include lust, idolatry, fornication, testing God, and complaining. Somebody says, what's the common denominator? These are all symptoms of a worldly attitude. And it ends with a couple of verses that sometimes we use in a very general way, which is fine. I don't think it's a misuse of either of these verses to use them in a general way. But notice they have a particular application to this study in particular. That's from the Department of Redundancy Department. And that is the following. Therefore, let him that thinketh he standeth take heed lest he fall. Does that count for America, who thought that the idols were off across the ocean someplace? Maybe so. And there hath no temptation taken you but that which is common man, but God is faithful, who will not suffer you to be tempted above that you are able, but will with the temptation make a way of escape that you may be able to bear it. All right, time I have remaining. We need to talk about the ethical response to idolatry. Now, all these things we said certainly are true. Bad as I've said idols are, I think they're probably worse than I've said. Bad as the attitudes are, I think they're probably worse than I've said. But what of the ethical response to idolatry in verses 14 through 33? Well, the first section is a fierce denunciation of idolatry in general, verses 14 through 22. There is no moral justification for instance, engaging in idolatrous feasts. That constitutes fellowship with them. And he gives us three principles that help us to understand that. Now, even if idols were purely a figment of the imagination, a nothing, verses 21 and 22, Paul suggests that, or rather 20 and 21, Paul suggests that some of these may have been constructed in honor of actual real demons, which makes the problem perhaps not worse, but more obvious. But the three principles he gives are the communion principle. That is, as Jesus said in Luke 22, this is my body, this is my blood, verses 19 and 20. And so one cannot be in communion with the Lord and in communion with idols. Number two is the sacrifice principle. That is, when one makes a sacrifice, he's in fellowship with the altar and by extension the Lord of the altar. Number three in general, the fellowship principle. You may notice in verse 21, Paul uses this language. He says, you cannot. What's that mean? Kaufman points out, it is forbidden. Not that it's not possible, it's forbidden. I would add to that, my thinking is, it's unthinkable that someone would do that. Now, if he has us all on the same page, the next thing we need to ask is this, and maybe this is the hardest question of all. What is the ethical response then to idolatry? Indirect idolatry, that is. At this point, we have to talk about some principles. It would be nice if the Bible directly and specifically answered every ethical question that we had. It would be nice. I'm not sure it would be good, because I can't imagine how big the Bible would have to be to answer every ethical question that every person ever had for 2,000 years. And sometimes people are disappointed in the Bible because it doesn't do that, and they say it doesn't have answers. Oh, yes, it does. It has all the answers. And maybe Paul was being sarcastic in verse 15 when he said, "You wise men." Either way, it's still true. Wise men and wise women ought to be able, by viewing those principles, to come to some decent conclusions about things that are not subject to thou shalt and thou shalt not. Things like eating meat. Now, sometimes people mistake what I'm about to say for what they've heard called situation ethics. I want to make sure you understand the difference, because what I'm about to tell you concerning are two different ways of handling situations, but the primary issue is one that's morally neutral. That is, we're not changing something that God has said is right or is wrong. In this case, it's the eating of meat. And it's morally neutral. Not situation ethics at all. Well, what's he say about that meat? Verse 26, he says it belongs to God. Doesn't matter where it used to be.
The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. Okay, there's our answer. We can eat anything. We don't have to worry about where it came from. I've eaten a lot of meals in my life, especially when we were in college, Andy. I did wonder where it came from. That's not what he's talking about, though, is it? In fact, he explicitly says, don't ask questions, verse 27. What's that mean? It means you might be eating meat that has been sacrificed to an idol and then resold. Now, this principle is subject to reversal, however, because what if your host, verse 28, makes a point of telling you, I bought this, this was sacrificed to an idol. What do you do then? That changes things. Did it change your meat? No. Did it change your intent? No. But he has revealed one of two things. Number one, either it is religiously significant to him, or number two, he's trying to put you on the spot and he's challenging you regarding idolatry. Now, Paul does not say, he doesn't change the truth on the topic when he says you're not to eat under those circumstances, does he? The earth is still the Lord's and the fullness thereof. I would also say this in a similar way. People, many Christians that I know have refrained from eating a meal in a church building. That's fine. I'm talking about those who think it's okay have refrained. That's fine. We're not going to change the truth on that. Even if we're not eating in a building, we still need to tell the truth that that principle isn't in the Bible. You understand what I'm saying? We can say we'll eat somewhere else so that people aren't bothered, but we're not going to change Bible doctrine to suit that false idea that the building is holy. Can't do that. Now, having brought up that topic in such a volatile way, let me show you how these principles work, in my opinion. How that we can apply these things. You know, in our Bible classes over the years, various times, I'm sure everybody in here who's a gospel preacher or maybe taught a Bible class has had somebody ask questions like this at one time or another. And I've come across some people who are very adamant about things like this. We shouldn't eat in a place where they serve alcohol. That gets discussed in a Bible class. I think this is the principle at hand here. How so? Well, my answer has always been, I think I know the difference between eating a meal in a restaurant that serves alcohol and eating a meal in a bar that serves food. Somebody else says, well, that's not good enough. You just shouldn't do that. Funny thing is, they all buy groceries from stores that sell liquor and buy gas from stores that sell liquor. Every single one of them do. Nonetheless, most of us can see that it would be a violation of these principles to say that a person could go into a bar and eat an otherwise moral cheeseburger because of the significance that's been attached to it at that point. Now, maybe more to the point is this question, and I've had this one come up too. Somebody will say, I just don't think that we should patronize businesses when we know that that person's in a false religious organization and he's using that to their glory. I've heard people say we shouldn't buy things from Catholics. Well, seems to me this principle comes in here. And also there is this principle. Once you have paid for something, once that money's out of your hand, it's not your responsibility. Acts chapter 5 and verse 4, when Peter was talking to Ananias, he said, whilst it remained, was it not your own? And after you sold it, was it not in thine own power? In other words, you had the choice of what to do because you still had the money. And the principle, it seems to me, applies here. How far do you take this? Because the truth is, unless you're dealing only with Christians, they're all going to do something ungodly with the money that you provided them. So somebody says, well, then it doesn't make any difference where we go or what we do then. Are you saying that? No, ma'am. No, sir. I'm not saying that. Because at some point, the other party makes it an issue. How? Let me give you an illustration. A few years ago, 25 years ago, best I can recall, there was a couple, husband and wife, who were professors at West Liberty College. They were very much opposed to abortion and for the government use of funding for abortion. And so they made the news because they refused to pay federal income tax when it was being used for such an ungodly purpose. In so doing, they ignored the explicit commandment given by Jesus in Matthew 22 and verse 21 regarding a corrupt and immoral Roman government. The second thing that we learned from them is this, because I Googled the whole incident and Google has never heard of them. And Google's heard of everything. And so the second lesson is, if you mess with the IRS, you're never heard from again. But no, I said, I'll give you an illustration to show how this does work. That's how it doesn't work. Let me tell you how I think it ought to work. Another modern day illustration. Can you verify that every time you buy goods or services that your money's not being misused? No, you can't, and I guarantee it is. But sometimes the merchant makes it an issue. Let me give you an illustration. Oreo decided to market rainbow-colored cookies. And they told us, we are going to pour money into the legalization of gay marriage, buy the rainbow cookies, endorse the perverts. What are you going to do? As far as I'm concerned, all their cookies are done. All of them. Now, does that mean they did good things with the money before that? Nope. But I didn't ask them the question before that, and they didn't make it an issue before that. Now they have. And if it were possible for me to snap my fingers and kill that company right now, I'd do it. That's pure wickedness, and I think that's what Paul's dealing with. Folks, we can't fix every problem. We can't wage every war. We certainly can't win every war. One thing that we can do is what Paul talks about at the end of the chapter, verses 29 through 33, and that is have a heightened awareness of the needs of those around us, and more than anything, as a priority, that all be done to the glory of God. Now, we can't answer every question. There are some things that might change from situation to situation. I'll readily acknowledge that. As we close this hour and as we close this block of lectures, I want to remind you of one thing that is not going to change. It's not subject to cultural revision or time revision. It's what our Lord said about salvation in Him. Jesus said, he that believes and is baptized shall be saved. That's good for every generation. That's right for you. If you're outside of Christ, we're going to sing this song as a song of invitation. We invite you to come as we stand and sing.
And